Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in public health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
There's a lot to talk about in the Media Project this week. We have the professor, the investigator, and the editor, and we are here for you each week from the posh studios of WAMC in Albany, New York, here in Central Avenue. That's said sarcastically because this is public radio, which is always appealing for your dollars and deserves them very well. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Rosemary Armeo, head of the journalism program at the University of Albany.
Hello.
Investigative reporter extraordinaire. And Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, professor emeritus, columnist, et cetera, et cetera.
I want to say what she said. Hello.
Hello. Hello. Hello to you all. Actually, what we need to talk about here is something that may seem a little bit counterintuitive because we're going to talk about too much news, in effect. People being so bombarded with the news that they are, in fact, depressed by it. I've heard this from readers saying, I just can't stand to pay attention to the news anymore. There's so much of it and it is so depressing. And the American Psychological Association, actually, has suggested some tips for what to do about the more than half of U.S. adults who say they feel very or somewhat stressed by the election.
You heard this from me. I took a break last night. I went out with friends. I came back. I did not turn on the television.
Really?
I had to take a break after the whole extravaganza the night before with the Supreme Court nomination. Mm-hmm. I just could not bear it another minute.
And so what happened when you didn't know what was going on? Were you managing to sleep, notwithstanding?
Well, there was some drinking involved.
Oh, there was some drinking involved.
Some drinking involved. That helped with the sleep.
Well, substitute alcohol, you know, for news. There you go.
You know, it is a basic premise that many of us follow, that people go to the news that they think is reflective of them.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just say, in Albany, New York, where we're broadcasting from, there are three major television stations. One of them has the reputation of being the liberal station. One of them has the reputation of being the reactionary station. One of them has the yogurt reputation.
The yogurt?
Yeah.
What's that?
Nondescript. You know.
Somewhere, I just thought it was like
somewhere in the middle.
Good microbes.
Okay.
Yeah,
good for
okay.
your stomach.
But here's the deal. You say half the country is depressed. That's right. And that is the half that voted for Hillary Clinton, or more than half. But it is not only depression that is brought on by having lost, because we're not seeing the same thing we saw during the George Bush time. We're seeing an anger. You know, 2.5 million people will turn out for marches around the country. And this is really becomes what I would call actionable. And I think it's reflective in our media.
I don't think it's just the people who were supporting the candidate who didn't get elected. I think there's just a general sense of news overload. People feel as though they're bombarded by it too much. I mean, the fact is we have media surrounding us all the time. Alan, you're a perfect example of this. You say that you get up 3 or 4 times in the middle of the night to read your iPhone. You get your New York Times feed.
That's well, that's only because I'm insomniac.
Weird. Oh,
yeah, and weird.
No, when I took my night off, I woke up this morning and my phone was beeping. Did you hear about New Zealand? Did you hear what he did with New Zealand?
Australia.
Iran and Yemen and, oh my God. And he doesn't know that Frederick Douglass is dead.
Frederick Douglass is dead, right?
Oh no, he's doing real well.
He's going to be making a lot of contributions to my community in America. I don't think it was just the depression. I felt that depression when Bush won, but this is definitely different, and I think the media is part of it, and so is the extraordinary presidency that we're seeing.
Well,
so,
but there has been also just a change in the environment. There's the incredible rise of social media really
right.
makes news
media.
Ubiquitous.
Yeah.
There's
you,
really
you
no
don't
way
get
out of
away
it.
From it.
Absolutely.
You know? You do not get away from it. So what do you do? Are you taking a break? I find that people are asking me, what do we do? They want direction.
Well, I can tell you this. I can tell you this much. If I turn on CNN, which we have on in the studio here, and there's some breaking news, I say, okay, that's worth watching. But I want to vomit when they take us to the, quote, let's go to the panel now, and the panel is sitting around.
So shut off Jeffrey Lord. That's a good recommendation.
And they say nothing. And so you say, oh, my God, this is terrible, and I turn it off.
Well, yes, but in our line of work, it's hard. We are involved in the media, and I feel a responsibility to just pay attention to everything. Plus, I also feel that I need to know what's going on with the news media itself. I need to follow the industry as well as follow the news in the industry to know what to do to lead the newsroom. And I personally do feel a terrible sense of overload. One of the suggestions from the American Psychological Association is to take a pause and return, kind of like what you did last night. I don't know if they're suggesting the alcohol part, but they're saying that
I would add that.
During the day, they say, step out and store up newsletters, perhaps. Now, I read newsletters a lot. I like aggregators of the news. Just keep in touch with the industry. I read the new Politico newsletter that Mike Pompeo does. Mike Allen has something called Axios, which is a new sort of news aggregator. But it's really hard to walk away from it, to put a pause button, in effect. Maybe we need to add that as a design factor on our websites, a pause button, so that it can come back to people later.
Some of this, it's interesting because we're talking about what the media can do in their product as they put it out. And I think a whole lot of it is news consumption. Some of this goes back to the readers. They have to figure out what they want to read and how much and when. And pets help. Exercise helps. A Big Bang Theory every once in a while helps. They're all forms of taking a break, just walking away from it and then coming back.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I follow you on the Big Bang Theory. I have some ideas of what that
it's
might
a comedy.
Be.
Just get away from totally. The
oh,
news.
I see. I thought it was something dirty.
I thought it was science.
Pro over. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what about? And there is this thing called the slow news movement, named after the slow food movement, yeah. Which maintains that, you know, it's healthier for consumers to cook and eat more slowly. You know, the slow news movement may be represented by people reading newspapers. Imagine that.
Rather than that bombardment of cable television, for example.
But now that's a difficult thing, and actually comes to a point that is raised by one of our listeners who writes us a letter, sadly, anonymously in Troy, though there's no reason it should be anonymous. There's nothing.
And there's no reason to read anybody's anonymous letter. Go ahead.
But it's an interesting point. Dear Anonymous here says, it's a roundabout way of getting to it, but it points out that the U.S. currently has a volunteer military, and the question is, who volunteers? And the answer is a lot of poor kids from small towns looking to get a leg up on life.
Sure.
Not coincidentally, among that population, there is the great distrust of the so-called liberal media, and that is a lot of what gave rise to the Trump election. So one question, so what this writer is saying, how does the mainstream media win back legitimacy in the eyes of this demographic in this time when it would be critical to do so? The answer is cover the wars, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and there may be others.
More coming.
Yeah, and there is more coming, yes. We'll be at war with Iran soon enough, it seems.
You know, actually, there was not a great deal of interest in that. Newspapers rushed into Afghanistan, for example, and then soon after came out, long before the troops came out. And then you couldn't get a story in about Afghanistan, not even involving American dead and injured in Afghanistan. There was no interest in that. And there is a feeling that some of this is that we are no longer invested in wars the way we had to be when our sons, not our daughters then, but our sons were registered for the draft and could go off.
It is an interesting phenomenon. I'm actually going to a conference in Washington next week of organizations that are involved in sponsoring exchanges with global partners. The International Center of the Capital Region is our local example of that. They bring people to this community, and we welcome these delegations into our newsroom and talk to them about First Amendment issues. But it is interesting. What I have to tell these people is that the difficulty that we confront is that we don't have great interest among our readers in international affairs. I wonder if that is a phenomenon that vanished after World War II. You know, in the immediate aftermath of this great global conflict, there was still a lot of interest in international affairs, and the media reflected that. Over the years, that has evaporated, hasn't it?
You know, Rex, the radio station where we're broadcasting from now, WAMC, plays the BBC overnight. And the BBC covers all of the wars and all of the carnage and all of this stuff. And every once in a while, I have to confess, it's a terrible thing, I got a classical music. Because I've heard it all before. It's terrible. But do I really have to hear it? And can I avoid it?
There's some of the sense about covering news in faraway places that's like covering the ozone level, a hole in the ozone layer. It's like, oh, wow, that's horrible, but, you know, what can I do about it? It's like, okay, it's getting worse
exactly.
and worse. The ice is melting. Okay, what can I do about it? And so reporters who cover, like, war in the Congo, in Central Africa, it's bigger than any war going on in modern times, really. And we don't care about it because it doesn't affect our trade. Few of us know people there. Few of us travel there. It's really hard to get people involved in a way that could perhaps make a difference in the war, pressure to go to the bargaining table.
But, you know, our rationale at a newspaper like the Times Union is we are predominantly a local news outlet. There is news that people will not get if they don't read it in the Times Union, the watchdog reporting on state and local affairs that we produce. So we have limited resources. We can't give over our pages to the same kind of stuff that people will see on their digital feed or on the nightly newscasts. It would be a waste of our resources to do that. Editors all across the country are saying the same thing. Sometimes, however, I feel awkward about that and think, okay, that is a rational business judgment. It's a rational sense of the right thing to do. But also, I'm the editor of a newspaper. I could be giving people a better sense of what's going on outside their little world mm-hmm. and try to raise their sights to more of what's going on globally.
Well, this is, of course, classic. Do you give them what they need or do you give them what they should have? Clearly, we all need to know what's going on in the rest of the world. But that, as you've just indicated, doesn't necessarily sell newspapers or radio stations.
You realize that we've been talking about two diametrically opposed problems. We're so attached and connected to the Trump news that it's making us sick, literally, physically sick.
Yep.
And yet we can't get people engaged or interested in even close to the same way in news that's happening elsewhere that still could definitely affect them. We're just not making that connection.
Unless it's branded by Trump, Rosemary. I mean, for example, the heroic stance of the Australian Prime Minister who's on the phone with Trump and who gives him hell. Now, that interests the American people. It certainly interests the 40% who didn't vote for Trump. And it, again, is...
Maybe 48. The 48% who didn't vote for him.
So sorry.
Yes.
So
I just want to make clear that the numbers are there. 46 got him.
You are so right, as usual, and I stand corrected.
It's an unprecedented victory.
Unprecedented.
You're the lying press.
Unprecedented.
Yeah, but, scum.
But then he became... Because it has to be understandable also. It has to be fed in a such a way that people will not throw up their hands and say, I don't understand this and I don't have the time for it. But the Australian guy becomes a hero.
Yeah, you know, what's difficult is that a lot of these international affairs really need Americans' attention if they're going to understand and make a good evaluation of what's going on in Washington. Iran is the perfect example. I would venture to say that a lot of Trump supporters in particular would say, by God, that's great that the president is standing up to Iran. The president's national security advisor says, we've put Iran on notice because they tested a missile. Our American allies around the world, as well as China and Russia, are not in support of the way Trump is pushing Iran's buttons. They see Iran as being a stabilizing force in the Middle East, and we don't need yet another destabilized operation or another conflict. And yet Americans are not taking the time to study this issue, will not do so. It's very hard for us to figure out, therefore, how do we get people to pay attention to what really is important?
Well, are you kidding? I mean, Rosemary comes in here, professor of journalism, comes in here day after day and tells us what her students who have chosen to go to the university don't know about nothing. And those are people who have chosen to go to the university as opposed to those who do not have this ostensible interest in world affairs.
It's not even so much that they don't know it. You would kind of expect that in kids so young, but they don't really know that they don't know it or want to know it.
I think the last one is the important one.
And I am feeling an increasing inability to transfer the knowledge I have. Some of that is experiential and generational, to give that to kids much younger than I am, young enough to be my grandchildren. I can't make them feel why it's not. I felt it with Hillary Clinton. Why could I not transfer to my millennial children my thoughts about why I thought she was a great person? And I told you this already, Mary Tyler Moore, that was a breakout show in the 70s. It showed women what their possibilities were. My students just don't get it at all. They just hated it. And that's relatively simple compared to why engaging in a contest of wills with Mexico or with Australia. Why, Australia. That's foolish and crazy. And Yemen, I mean, Americans don't even know where Yemen is. And Trump got people killed. He got American military people killed in Yemen because he wants to be a big cowboy and didn't do his homework. Where did we get that story? We got it from leaked military officials. When did the military give us information about botched operations? Have you ever heard of that? Not too much. Bay of Pigs.
If you're just joining us, this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio, and you can share your thoughts, media@wamc.org, or that letter we read earlier actually is a piece of mail.
And we prefer it if you sign your name.
That would be a very kind thing to do. Alan Shartok, Rosemary Armeo, and Rex Smith here, and we are offering you a little bit of insight into the media issues of the week, we believe. By the way, one of the things that we've complained about in the past is, quote, fake news. That is a lot of stuff that appears, especially in social media, that seems real and is not. And of course, there were some tragic results. The fellow who went to Washington to shoot up a pizza shop because he thought that Hillary Clinton was running a child pornography ring there. Facebook is prioritizing authentic content in its news feed with an algorithm change that detects and promotes content that people consider genuine and not misleading, sensational, or spammy. Mm. So finally, Facebook has for years said, oh, no, we're not a journalism organization. We're just a platform. You know what? They are beginning to behave like a genuine news organization that they are. They are, in fact, content purveyors. They are content curators, which is another term for editors. And it's appropriate for Facebook to finally do something and do a little bit more with their third-party fact-checkers, which they need to be a little bit more responsible about this.
But they have so many billions of messages. Yesterday, my son, who's in New Orleans, called me and said, gee, Dad, what did you say yesterday? You know, you got a whole bunch of Twitters calling you a communist and other things. This is a little bit more unusual than most. I mean, how do you filter out all of these people's pages and messages? I don't think it's possible.
I think that's true. It's not possible entirely, but, you know, you try to do the best you can. And for our part, as mainstream media, we need to just keep doing our job. As we have seen, we are still constantly under attack from the White House, from people asserting that we're not telling the truth when, in fact, we are writing the truth. And I get this reflected in letters to me from people who are partisans of President Trump saying, why are you all this fake bad news about President Trump? Why didn't you do that about Obama? We were tough on Obama. We did report about Obama.
And you heard the same thing under Clinton. We were easy on Clinton and harder on Bush, and it was never true. I was the editor of a paper that printed a picture of Bush. I got all these complaints about how we made him look stupid. The picture came from his own website. We took it off of his website. So it's all that perception thing. I don't know. I wish that Facebook had done this long ago, definitely before the last election. I think this is coming way too late. They are going to make mistakes. We'll be talking at some time in the future on the show about some great story that their algorithm sent to the bottom or ditched. And fine, editors make mistakes, but at least they're making an effort. And I think that we in the media have to, and on a personal level too, have to engage with people who promote and talk about fake news. None of that, oh, what's the point of talking to them? They'll never listen. I'm rejecting that argument. And I argue back and say, well, that doesn't make any sense. Here, there's this and that. Well, how can you think that's true? And argue back, because we do have truth on our side. So let's use it.
Yeah.
I'm getting a lot of mail, Rex, from people who are very angry at NPR because of their refusal to call a lie a lie.
Oh, because Mike Oreske said that he would use different wording rather than lie.
Yes,
I wrote a column about that.
And, you know, people are saying, spineless, I'll give you the money for WAMC, but can I guarantee that none of that money goes?
Oh, now that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. You know what? It is a matter of a journalistic nuance. NPR does great reporting, brave reporting, direct reporting. What they're saying is that using that term lie alienates a certain number of listeners, and they're trying to be just a little bit more respectful of that. I don't know if that's the right decision or not, but that's a ridiculous decision to say I'm going to withhold my money from NPR, which does great journalistic work. That is outrageous.
See, that
behavior.
Kind of passion and yelling back is what we have to do.
Well,
more.
Tell none your listeners, this. Alan, not to be stupid like that.
Well, but how about, but Rexy?
That'll win them over.
But Rexy, how about all the people who write you stupid letters? You're always telling us about them and saying what they say and how ridiculous they may be. All I'm doing is reporting to you that I have had several, and I mean several letters, saying that NPR inability to call a lie is very important to them.
They are truth tellers. NPR is, in fact, holding the powerful to account. I listen to NPR a lot, and I'm very impressed with the reporting. The depth that they bring to stories is significant, and it's not easy in a broadcast environment because you only have a certain amount of time, and it's sequential. You know, here's this story, and then that story, and then that story. It's not like a newspaper where a reader can skip around and do a little bit of this and a little bit of that. So I think it's admirable what NPR does. And for people to say, I'm going to withhold my money when there is a threat of the government pulling its money away from public broadcasting is irresponsible on the part of the listeners. Mm-hmm. So there, listen to that, listeners.
Well, you are, you know, you are very vehement and, as Rosemary says, passionate in your views on this. Nevertheless, we like people to say what they think.
Well, you know, and NPR isn't the only one who's getting criticism for it's sticking to the rules. The Wall Street Journal, we have a story about this. Do you have that one, Rex?
Yes.
Where the editor said, okay, we have a big dispute over what to call, I call it the Muslim ban, I think that's what it is, but the president and Sean Spicer, that little stupid leprechaun, is saying, no, it isn't a ban. So the editor has said, okay, we can call it a ban, but make sure you let people know that's not the only way to characterize it. In other words, give the other side. That seems very reasonable to me, and yet is being taken as a sign that the Wall Street Journal is getting soft on the administration. What do you think?
I don't think so, but I think it's good to keep your eyes open, and there is a new effort to monitor the Wall Street Journal to make sure that its editorial page isn't seeping into its news coverage, because the Wall Street Journal has been, let's say, softer on its editorial page on Mr. Trump than other major newspapers. And what happened was Jerry Baker, the editor-in-chief, said, you know, let's not just refer to them as Muslim-majority countries. And he had to clarify, well, there's no ban on the phrase Muslim-majority country, but we should just always be careful that this term is not offered as the only description of the countries that are included in the ban. And Lydia Polgreen, the editor-in-chief of Huffington Post, was on a platform with him, and she said, absolutely right. You could call them many things. You could call them seven countries whose residents have never attacked the United States, have never done anything contrary, have never had that. So it is an interesting way to think of it.
Seven random countries that have nothing to do with their religion. Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah. One person inside the Wall Street Journal said that the editor, Jerry Baker, was going out of his way to whitewash the newspaper's coverage. That sounds a little unfair to me, too. These are all matters of nuance, and journalism really needs to handle nuance. We need to work well in these shades of gray, and people who hold strong political views would rather that we just reflect their political views rather than effectively handle nuance.
That could be, Rex, but I would leave our listeners with this as I run out the clock. I think a lie is a lie is a lie is a lie, and I think we have the right to say it.
Okay. I would say that in my news stories, I would...
I worry about it. There's a backlash
tough.
If you do that.
Yeah.
Tough noogies.
You desensitize to the term. You just become, the negative press who hates Trump and is, we never called anything Obama did a lie. How can we treat him different? And that's hard to argue because we were hard on Obama. I get mail all the time about how I'm mean to Obama, but I never called him a liar. I have called Trump a liar.
Mm-hmm.
Also ignorant and other things, all of which are true, but, you know, they get you into trouble with readers who
speak differently. So you tell the truth and let it play out where it goes.
I think you can tell the truth without calling names.
As Emily Dickinson wrote, tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies. Think on that. The Media Project, Rosemary Arimeo, Alan Chartok, and Rex Smith. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.
Extra, read all about it. It's a mess meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Chartok is CEO of WAMC, Professor Emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. And Rosemary Arimeo is the director of the Journalism Program at the University at Albany. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
Read all about it. It's a mess meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling, ling-a-ling, ling. Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people when they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's a